Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C. A Nigerian group calls on human rights institutions not to invite First Lady Aisha Buhari to their programs.
No human rights platform in the world should allow this platform to Aisha Buhari. That even for programs she has been invited for already, she should be deplatformed.
A human rights defender calls on the U.S. administration not to include Equatorial Guinea's President Obiang Mbazogu in the upcoming U.S.-Africa Leadership Summit.
The U.S. is about to host the U.S.-Africa Leadership Summit. President Obiang is given a speaking role. What is the message that you're sending to the people in Equatorial Guinea?
And the Southern African regional group says peace and security are central to the organization's work toward regional integration and improving the lives of residents in the region. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Concerned Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law, a political pressure group, is calling on human rights institutions not to invite First Lady Aisha Buhari to their programs. The group says this will deter those accused of abusing the rights of citizens. The statement comes as the National Association of Nigerian Students, or NANS, said it will embark on a nationwide protest over the arrest of Aminu Mohammed, a student who was arrested for criticizing First Lady Aisha on Twitter. The arrest, the students' group and the human rights organization say, violated the constitutional provision protecting free speech. The charges against Aminu have been dropped, police say, at the request of the First Lady. Deji Adeyanju, the convener of Concerned Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law, tells me that the arrest was an affront to democracy and rule of law.
No human rights platform in the world, whether the United Nations, you know, or women international bodies, or anybody that subscribes to the articles of the United Nations, or other sundry related covenants, you know, where covenant declarations and other things about human rights should allow this platform to Aisha Buhari, that even for programs she has been invited for already, she should be deplatformed. You know, so that's our call, and our call is very simple.
But the First Lady is not the person who is alleged to have arrested the critic. And people are saying they're calling for her to be deplatformed by both local and international human rights organization programs. It's not fair.
People hailed Hitler when Hitler was committing human rights violations. So no one should be surprised that some people are still supporting Aisha Buhari. Clear human rights violations of student Aminu Adamu Mohammed, because some people will just never, you know, do what is right in this life. He was brought to the villa. He was beaten. So what other evidence is needed to call for her deplatform, and that she should never be made allowed to speak on any international platform, either local or domestic, on anything about human rights?
What is the significance of this deplatform?
Yes, it serves as a deterrence to, you know, people who are power drunk. You know, Nigeria is the headquarters of leaders, of African leaders with God complex. Leaders who feel that they cannot be criticized, they cannot be questioned. Freedom of speech, like I have always said, includes freedom, the ability to insult. If you feel insulted, if you feel slighted, if you feel defamed, if you feel a libelous or a slanderous statement has been made against you, it is left. Several courts in this country have said libel and slander, defamation, is not a criminal matter. After one conference of the state, a Supreme Court of Appeal, there are so many Supreme Court of Appeal decisions on this issue. Why is the police still abusing our laws? This should not be topical issues in the 21st century. This is not what we should be discussing as an underdeveloped country where we have the highest poverty index ratios in the world, the poverty capital of the world. And these are the kind of things that further deepens Nigeria in human rights ranking, because it will now be said, it will be used as a reference point. When human rights reports come now, people will start saying, why is Nigeria among the great abusers of human rights in the world? These are the indices that are used.
Deji Adeyanju is the convener of Concerned Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Tutu Alicante, the executive director of the non-governmental organization called Equatorial Guinea Justice, says the U.S. government's critical reaction to the recent elections in Equatorial Guinea is a positive development. He says the administration in Washington should go a step further by not including President Teodoro Obiang Nguema Mbazogo in the coming U.S.-Africa Leadership Summit in Washington. Alicante's statement came after the U.S. said it had serious doubts about the credibility of the results of the recent polls. This after the country's constitutional court approved the results that election authorities announced. The incumbent president was declared winner with about 95% of the vote cast. Tutu Alicante tells me that the results demonstrate a lack of commitment to the democracy where citizens choose their own leaders without intimidation or harassment from authorities.
For me, it was about time that the U.S. would make a strong statement. In my opinion, it doesn't go far enough. Evidence of intimidation is there. Most nations should come out and say, we cannot, in good honesty, recognize the results of these elections, given everything that civil society and the opposition has said. So you should contrast what the U.S. has said with what the African Union, who sent 50 observers to Equatorial Guinea, has said, right? So it is, for me, insufficient, because we need to get to a point recognizing that it's an autocratic government where not only do we decry what has happened, but we go against what has happened, because this is not just democratic backsliding, but autocracy on the rise.
But Tutu, what can these other countries that you're talking about do? Because President Teodoro Obiang Nguema Mbazogo, who is the longest serving head of state, will continue since he was declared the winner.
Yeah. The U.S. is about to host the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. President Obiang, who just won with 95% of the vote, as you just mentioned, is not only invited to come to Washington, D.C., but is given a speaking role. What is the message that you're sending to the people in Equatorial Guinea and to democracy lovers, freedom fighters around the world, when someone that is winning illegitimately, or that's winning, that is claiming illegitimate elections like this, you invite him to Washington a couple of weeks later and you give him a speaking role at the U.S. African leadership? It tells me that you're not taking it seriously. The U.S. has never invited, for those countries that it considers serious autocracies, it has never invited to Washington, D.C.
Are you therefore saying the U.S. government should not invite the Equatorial Guinean president to participate in the U.S. Africa Leadership Summit?
Yes, I am saying that the Biden administration should put its money where its mouth is.
Supporters of the ruling party are saying that the opposition should go and prepare and come back better prepared next time in order to form or have any possible challenge to the candidates of the ruling party, and that the lack of unity within the opposition, the lack of a coherent message from the opposition, and not the president who won re-election. How do you respond to that?
Anyone that knows Equatorial Guinea knows that for the last four decades, President Obiang has controlled everything. He has built an entire system based on patronage. So, and President Obiang has come forward just last year and said textually that the only chance the CPDS, the major political opposition party, has of having any seats in parliament is to join an alliance with the ruling party. That is basically offering to buy off the opposition. I'm going to take the word of President Obiang himself, who is telling the opposition that the only way they're going to have any seats is to join them.
So where do you think things go from here following the declaration of the election result?
So if we are going to be serious at the international level, is that the U.S., the European Union, the EU should stop taking countries like those as legitimate democracies. Why do you have coups in places like Burkina Faso, Guinea, Mali, etc.? It's because people have gotten tired of this type of government. If we want to avoid coups, if we want to avoid people taking to the streets, we have to really, at the international level, promote citizens' participation in democracy.
Tutu Alicante is the executive director of the non-governmental organization called Equatorial Guinea Justice. He spoke with me from here in Washington. Elias Mpedi Magosi The executive secretary of the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, says peace and security is central to the organization's work toward regional integration and improving the lives of residents in the region. SADC, Magosi says, worked closely with all stakeholders in Lesotho to help the kingdom establish reforms as part of the effort to promote peace, stability, and democracy. He also says efforts by the organization are helping to combat terrorism in Mozambique. His remarks follow the recent extraordinary ministerial committee meeting of the Organ on Politics, Defense, and Security Cooperation in the Namibian capital, Windhoek. He tells me that SADC is committed to preventing conflict and resolving them peacefully.
So peace and security has been so key and central. And we look at peace across the board. If we think peace has been threatened in one part of the region, we come together and they create structures that then support that particular country. If you looked at Lesotho was going through multiple areas of instability of government not sustaining for quite some time. So we assisted the Kingdom of Lesotho first to the citizens to find themselves, to talk among themselves. And that is why they created the reforms that are now we are celebrating that are coming to an end. So we've been working and running with Lesotho all the way to this point in time. Mozambique, as you are aware, they developed this issue of terrorism in 2017. I think it heightened in there. And we felt as a region that not only is our sister country being exposed and being attacked, but this has a potential to actually spread. So we felt it was important to stem it.
How is the intervention going on there so far in Mozambique per SADC's deployment of troops there?
Well, we can say that it's going on fairly well. We've stabilized the Cabo Delgado area. When you went in, there was, the terrorists were all over in that province. And the multiple member states that are there, that are in the different parts of Cabo Delgado, have managed now to contain. And in fact, we have now moved out to the most of the terrorists from the main villages. The agencies that deal with humanitarian relief are now back in and starting to do their work.
Peace and stability are the ingredients that need to be in place in order to promote democracy. In Africa, when there are elections, there are doubts, people try to contest election results and all that. What specific areas and structures and measures is SADC implementing to ensure the promotion of democracy?
We do have our guidelines that are guiding how we run elections in our region. And we do have structures, one being the SADC election observer mission. At every country when there are elections, this observer mission is actually established. And it goes in there and it uses these guidelines to determine the readiness of the country. And when we finish elections, we produce a report. And this report clearly articulates where the country is doing well, where there are gaps, and how they're able to close those gaps. What is critical with these missions is that we engage all stakeholders. Peace and security is foundational, as you said, but for us it's also foundational. You can achieve regional integration and economic activity, economic and social development if there is no peace. No one can come in and invest their funds, their money, or support us, or even our citizens stay here if there is no peace. So that becomes really a core of what we need to do. So I thought maybe I should just highlight those aspects on the peace and security areas.
Yeah, you mentioned countries like Mozambique and Lesotho with reforms. Recently, a lot of people in Eswatini have raised issues. They've called on SADC to try to help mediate a dialogue, to try to find some peace and stability in that part of SADC. What are you doing about it?
So the national dialogue, SADC as a regional bloc has felt it's an important process that the country has to go through, but it has to be driven and supported by the government and the citizens themselves. So we are really advocating for that national dialogue. So we've developed a framework. which we are now we've given to the government to engage. The new chair, the previous chair was President Ramaphosa, who led all these missions in. Now we have a new chair, President Gengob, who's also now working very closely and has just had a recent meeting with His Majesty to work towards assisting him so we can get this process going. I think the important thing that I can say, obviously there's agitation, there's impatience that we often are experiencing from the citizens themselves. And we, through our leaders, we have consistently said, calm and peace should remain and should prevail within the kingdom. Even as people are having differences of opinions, it doesn't mean this have to now be escalated.
Elias Mpedi Magosi is the Executive Secretary of the Southern African Development Community, or SADC. He spoke with me from Botswana's capital, Gaborone. The leader of the opposition Botswana Patriotic Front, or BPF, is calling for unity among the group's leadership. Biggy Butali says there appears to be external pressure seeking to oust him from the party he formed, but critics have questioned his leadership style and warned other opposition groups may not trust him to lead a coalition ahead of the next general election. Some analysts say the BPF is the main opposition party that other groups want to partner with for the elections. They add, however, that the turbulence within the party will enable the ruling party to win the next election due to its dominance since the country's independence. But Biggy Butali tells me the BPF is mending fences to ensure unity in the effort to wrestle power from the ruling party.
Some members of our party that I believe were influenced by outside forces tried to make a hostile takeover of the party. And this has caused disharmony and disunity in the party. And, you know, taking into account the fact that we are going to elections in 2 years' time, this didn't bode well for the opposition collective as a whole. Reason being that our party is really the core party that is holding the opposition together so that come the 2024 general elections, we approach them as a unit. And because of this turbulence in our party, a lot of people were beginning to lose hope that perhaps come 2024, the ruling party would just win easily as they've been doing over the years.
But some people are suggesting that if your party, which is the core holding the other opposition political parties together, is faced with challenges of disunity, why would the other political parties trust you?
They understood and could see that this turbulence was caused by what I call a third force. It includes the government and the intelligence services. And so everybody could see what was happening. And they are all relieved that we've been able to get over this hurdle. And hopefully come 2023, 2024, we'll be able now to focus more on the campaign for the general elections.
Why blame somebody else? Your leadership is being questioned, and that you have not been able to unify the party. You have not been able to give the party direction. And that is why there is turbulence within your party. How do you respond to such criticisms?
Not at all. The great majority of the members of the party are solidly behind me. The instability came from the top echelons of the party. A small number of individuals professed to be unhappy at how the party was run. And in my opinion, they fomented reasons to point out and say that there's instability in the party. And these reasons were manifested by themselves, basically. But we've managed to overcome this turbulence, as I call it. And I believe that now we can focus on the general elections. And I can tell you the ruling party is not pleased at all.
Why do you think the ruling party is not pleased, especially when it has dominated Botswana politics since independence?
The ruling party has been running the affairs of Botswana for close to six decades now. And a great majority of the citizens are saying that six decades of one-party rule is more than enough. And not only that, the COVID-19 epidemic has decimated the tourism sector in this country, which is the second largest foreign exchange earner. And a lot of people have been laid off And as you can imagine, the trickle-down effects of this devastation is being felt by all sectors of the economy. And on top of that, for some reason, the state of corruption skyrocketed during the pandemic.
But why do you think the opposition is a better alternative?
The economy has tanked because of COVID partly. The incidents of corruption have gone exponentially high, and everybody can see that all is not well. The ruling party has only got 24 months to try and turn things around, and even if they could take loans from the World Bank and the African Development Bank and try to throw money at the various problems that the country is facing, I don't think they have time enough for the money to trickle down to the ordinary man in the street.
Biggie Butale is the leader of the main opposition Botswana Patriotic Front, or BPF. He spoke with me from the capital, Harbour Road.
Direct from Washington, the voice of America, VOA.
Rebels with the March 23 movement, or M23, have denied the military accusation they carried out a massacre of civilians as a truce between the sides break down. For VOA, Ruth Omar from Goma, Democratic Republic of Congo, has more.
Brigadier General Sylvain Ekenge accused March 23 movement rebels, known as M23, and their random backers of targeting Congolese civilians. He spoke Thursday at a press conference in Kinshasa.
Les forces de défense du Rwanda.
Rwanda has denied supporting M23 rebels. The general also accused the rebels of abduction and forced recruitment of youth into their rank. M23 rejected the allegations and accused the Congolese army of breaking a week-long truce. In an interview with VOA Friday, M23 spokesman Lawrence Kanyuka accused the Congolese National Army of attacking their positions and called for a dialogue.
The DRC government started a war last night, attacked the position of Kishishi, which means that the bridge, actually, the ceasefire was actually put in place on the 25th.
DRC General Ekenge said Congolese forces had upheld the truce. The ceasefire was agreed between DRC President Felix Tshisekedi and Rwandan President Paul Kagame at a November 23rd summit in Angola. The M23 rebels were not part of the deal, but there was no fighting reported between the two sides until Thursday's clashes. The M23 rebels are ethnic Tutsis who say the government broke a deal to integrate them into the army. They began seizing territory in November last year and in October this year moved toward the city of Goma. The East African community has deployed hundreds of troops from Burundi and Kenya as part of a regional force to quell the violence. Nairobi this week also hosted peace talks with regional leaders and some rebel groups. M23 representatives were not invited to the talks as Kinshasa says it will not engage with them until they give up occupied territories. Ruth Omar for VOA News, Goma, Democratic Republic of Congo.
It is the biggest sports event of the year, the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. Join VOA to celebrate Africa's king sport. In-depth coverage, breakout stars, Cinderella teams, coaches, players, and let's not forget the fans from the four corners of the continent and from the city of Doha. Don't miss the fun with Team VOA Africa. Let's experience the magic of football together.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mike Harvey, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. Up next is the podcast about the World Cup.
40 greetings to all our Voice of America viewers and listeners. Welcome to episode 3 of On Goal with Sonny and Muckbill. I'm Sonny Young, joined by Muckbill Yabberow. Muckbill, I brought back my South Africa jersey for episode 3, but looks like you're sporting some red and green.
I definitely had to find a Moroccan jersey, and luckily for me, a good friend of mine gifted me this jersey, or so I think. Definitely not giving it back.
Yeah, the Atlas Lions of Morocco, arguably the best African team in the World Cup.
Yeah, I definitely don't know who would have expected them to finish atop that group with Belgium and Croatia and Canada as well. Finishing at the top of the group, I'm sure all Moroccans all over the world and Africans all over the world are super excited to see the Atlas Lions in the next knockout phase.
Now, one of our colleagues, super excited, Muckbill, she might even want that Moroccan jersey. Salwa Jafari, Africa Division Director here at the Voice of America. The pride of Morocco. She wants that jersey, Muckbill.
It's definitely very possible. It's definitely very possible. I don't know if I can give it up, though. We're definitely going to have to keep up with the Atlas Lions and see how they do against a very, very strong Spain side. I definitely like how they've been playing. And as you mentioned earlier, they've been playing stellar football from all different parts of their team. Very complete. They've shown us that they have exactly what it takes to win in the next level.
Who have been some of the key players, Muckbill, in your opinion, for the Atlas Lions?
If I were to definitely say, I would have to go with my guy, PSG, Ashraf Hakimi, who is basically the workhorse for this team on the back, playing in the defense. You also could mention Yassine Bounou, who is their goalkeeper, who plays for Sevilla. Amazing goalkeeper. We spoke about this on our World Cup spotlights that he won recently, the Zafora Trophy, which for those that don't know is the most efficient goalkeeper in La Liga. Very, very difficult to do. And he only conceded one goal, which was an own goal, right? And he still got his hand on that ball. So he's definitely done what he's needed to do. And we have so many other players, but it's a very, very complete team, this Moroccan side.
If we go back through our history books, Muckbill, I think it's been 36 years since Morocco reached the round of 16 at a World Cup. They lost, I believe, to the then West Germany in the round of 16. Now they go up against the 2010 World Cup champion, Spain. But I think the Moroccans might have more confidence than the Spaniards.
I definitely think so. When we look at Spain and what they've done normally, right, this is a very dominant European team, plays this classic style of pass, amazing. It's almost like music. It's symphony almost, the way that these guys pass the ball to each other. And they showed us that in their opening match against Costa Rica, where they gave Costa Rica 7-0. So I think after that introductory game, we all felt as though Spain was the team to beat. Unfortunately for them, after that, they came up against Germany, who's another amazing story in this World Cup, unfortunately, who were knocked out in that very difficult group. It was an amazing draw. Very, very good tactical game, but both teams were unable to defeat each other. And then they play in their last game and they lose. So it's like they've shown us everything that they have. A win, a draw, a loss. Which Spain will Morocco play? That is the question. Whereas Morocco's been very consistent, has not lost a single game just yet.
Well, Muckbill, the Atlas Lions of Morocco, they're part of a pride of lions at this World Cup. We have the Lions of Teranga from Senegal. They made it to the quarterfinals at the 2002 World Cup in Japan and South Korea. Now they're knocking on the door again in Qatar. They go up against more lions. The three roar! The lions! The lions! The three lions of England. How do you see that match?
Man, Sonny, I honestly definitely say that this is a very, very exciting game. Senegal versus England. They've both shown that they are super explosive on the offensive end. They can both score with the best of them. We saw England's opening match against Iran, 6-2, right? So they showed us they can do that. But on the other side, we have a Senegalese side who, to me, have shown the most progress in this group stages where they've only constantly kept getting better. They played their first game against the Dutch, which for 83 minutes was a game that was their game to lose. You know, Gakpo goes in at the 84th minute with a classic header that puts the Dutch up and really just demoralizes this team. But for 83 minutes without their star Sadio Mane, the Senegalese side showed why they are such a complete team, why they should be here even without their... Sadio Mane was ranked top 10 player coming into this World Cup. To lose somebody of that magnitude, it would have been crushing for any other team, but they've shown us with their resolve and their perseverance that they really want it for their entire team and their country. And honestly speaking, England has shown us those strong points, but they've also shown us some games where U.S. and England was a draw, and the U.S. definitely showed us that they showed us the blueprint on what you need to do in order to put England into their place. So hopefully Senegal was able to watch that game.
Mukbil Yabaro, I'm Sonny Young. You're on goal with Sonny and Mukbil. Let's go to Doha, Qatar, where VOA's Kali Abdu is standing by. Sporty World Cup greetings, Kali.
Same to you, my brother. I love the energy in the studio right now. You guys are enjoying the World Cup.
Well, Kali, we got those lions from Africa, the lions of Teranga, the Atlas Lions from Morocco. What do you think of two African teams in the round of 16, Kali?
I mean, you have to be here to see the energy Morocco especially has here. I don't know if you noticed, but they seem to be a home team here. They have a tremendous amount of support. So many fans who came from Morocco. Some live here, but they have a ton of support. And obviously, Senegal have done well to progress. And they have some fans here, people who have traveled from Europe and some from Africa as well. But so far, the spirits are high in both camps. And we're rooting for them, absolutely.
Yes, Kali, to follow up on that, what are your thoughts on I know Ghana unfortunately did not win their game against Uruguay, and also Tunisia was able to defeat France. So these two teams that didn't make it to the next knockout stages. Tell me a little bit about that pride for the Tunisians to be able to defeat the world champions and Ghana making it difficult so that Uruguay also doesn't advance to the next level.
Well, before I speak on Ghana, let me tell you, we were at the Fan Fest when Tunisia beat France and the place erupted. You know, everybody was cheering them on, even though they didn't make it because obviously Australia advanced. Everybody was very proud of them. You can't say the same about Ghana. I'm going to tell you right now, all the journalists from Africa were really disappointed because of how the Ghana game ended. You know, they started well, they started getting a penalty, and then we were all cheering them on. The South American journalists were holding their heads. You know, they couldn't watch. And then once they missed that penalty, it went downhill pretty fast for them. And we didn't understand what was going on. But, you know, like you said, Uruguay didn't progress because the South Koreans showed a tremendous spirit. But there was something that we were expecting. We expected the Ghanaians to come in really strong in this game because of obviously the 2010 game versus Uruguay. And when we talked to their fans here, they were so buoyant, so confident, man, we're going to beat them 3-0, 4-0. I was surprised to hear that, but that was the type of energy that we were expecting. We thought it would be guns blazing from minute one, but for some reason, watching the Ghana game, they seemed so terrified. The occasion seemed too big for them for whatever reason. So it was interesting to watch.
Kali, I felt like that penalty kick in the first half taken by Andre Dede Ayew was really the game changer. That after the Uruguayan keeper saved the shot, I just thought the momentum shifted right there. That Uruguay took control And, you know, Ghana looked deflated after that. But strategically, Kali, Mukbil and I kind of felt like the young player for Ghana, Mohamed Kudus, who's been such an inspiration for the Black Stars, that he should have been the one to take the penalty kick and not Dede Ayew. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you're spot on. I told my colleague, if Ghana had nine other Kuduses on the field, it would have been really tough for Uruguay. His name was everywhere, just Kudus, Kudus, Kudus the whole game. You couldn't say the same about his teammates. Ayew, for some reason, just from minute five, I told my colleague, he seems off. He just doesn't seem up for this. And I was surprised to see him taking the penalty, which obviously he missed. But you know, there's also another player. I don't recall if he was playing, but Williams, I think he plays in La Liga. He's the designated penalty taker for Athletic Bilbao. So there are other players that could have taken a penalty that I think might have converted. But, you know, this is football. Could have, would have, should have, you know. They didn't convert it, and now they're out. And, you know, they can only have themselves to blame for sure.
Kali, just sticking on that same point, do you think there was a part of maybe Coach Ayew that thought to himself, maybe putting that level of pressure on such a young player, Mohamed Kudus, you know, he's only 22 years old, he's the future of Ghanaian football. Like we said, you know, a penalty kick is 50-50. If he misses a penalty kick on a game like today with such, you know, implications from the past, do you think that that could, you know, in essence, hurt him really? So maybe they didn't want to put that burden on this younger player? Is that a possibility?
Yes. Yes, you're totally right. That might have well been the thinking. I don't know if you recall England in the Euros, Saka, Rashford, all these really young, talented players playing penalty kicks and missing. You remember how much backlash there was in the media and things like that. And so, yeah, a lot of coaches are very skeptical of throwing their young players in. I mean, let's not forget, Ghana has one of the most, had one of the most inexperienced sides in this entire tournament. So, I mean, if Dede Ayew wasn't on the pitch, they might have been forced to just let any of these youngsters take it anyway. But, you know, like I say, they didn't give Kudus the opportunity to play the penalty kick. So we will never know. Maybe he would have scored, maybe he would have missed. But Ayew really had the weight of Ghana on his shoulders, and I expected more. I told my colleague, from the way he was poised, his run up, I said, man, this guy's going to miss, and he missed. It's just something about confidence in football that is just, you know, it was just obvious to me that he just didn't seem super confident. And I didn't expect that from him with all his experience.
Kali Abdu speaking with us from Doha, Qatar. Thank you, Kali.
Thank you, gentlemen. Enjoy the rest of your day.
I'm Sonny Young, joined by Mukbil Yabaro. You are On Goal with Sonny and Mukbil. We'll be right back after this short break.
It is the biggest sports event of the year, the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. Join VOA to celebrate Africa's king sport. In-depth coverage, breakout stars, Cinderella teams, coaches, players, and let's not forget the fans from the four corners of the continent and from the city of Doha. Don't miss the fun with Team VOA Africa. Let's experience the magic of football together.
The magic of football, Sunday Shamari. He's having a lot of fun in Doha, Mukbil. You know, I want to get back to that penalty kick taken by Dede Ayew. It's easy for us to second guess, you know, after a player, and I'm sure he's just, you know, really not feeling real good tonight in Qatar. But he looked a little tentative, I thought, when in the run up to the kick.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you. And we have Jackson on the line as well. And I'm sure he could tell us what the feelings are in Accra when Ayew missed that goal. Jackson, welcome. Welcome, Jackson. How you doing, brother?
Hello, guys. Sporty greetings from Accra.
Sporty greetings, Jax. As we were talking, we were just mentioning the Ghana game. And unfortunately, I'm sure you know how it feels. The mood in Accra, I'm sure, is not amazing, having lost to Uruguay. But talk to us a little about that goal, like the penalty kick that Captain IU had missed. What are your thoughts on that?
Listen, that was a match, like it was one of those opportunities that you miss. And when in hindsight, when I'm sure they're going to look back and just kick themselves, because if they had just made that penalty, this was like in the early minutes, it would have been a game changer. It would have changed the dynamics of the game. And you know, the funny thing is I was watching the 2010 game between Uruguay and the Black Stars in Soweto, the one where Suarez used his hand to block that the ball that would have actually taken them to the semifinals, and the subsequent penalty was by Asamoah Gyan was missed, and then they went into penalties because at the time it was in extra time, and they all missed their penalties. And when I saw that, it was just deja vu all over. So much heartbreak here in Accra, man. I'm at the hotel, and it just started raining. There was an event going on, people playing live music, I think some a non-soccer-related event. But just the downpour and how it just, like, spoiled the party for everybody was just felt like a metaphor for what happened today.
Jackson, I know Black Stars fans have to be very disappointed, but they also have a lot to really be proud of. This is a Black Stars team, one of the youngest at the World Cup. They certainly did some really nice things in Qatar. Mohamed Kudus played very well. What's your sense about the future direction of this Black Stars team?
No, first of all, they, you know, let's just say Ghana went into this, they needed to a win or a draw for them to move ahead. But, you know, when you look at the team, the people that I spoke to, the former Black Stars, I spoke to two former Black Stars who looked at this, you know, I asked them, you know, just give me an understanding of what you think about this Black Stars going forward. And they were really encouraged by the talent, the skill level, the cohesion. Many of these guys don't even play together, but when they were on that pitch, at least on Tuesday, we saw the possibility of what they can do, what they're potentially able to do. And so going forward, I'm not sure they're going to stay with Coach Otto Addo. You know, I think this might be his final. He might have, you know, saluted goodbye to them. But whichever coach comes in, he's starting with a group of young men that have a lot of potential. They have a bright future ahead of them.
Jackson was able to speak with a former member of the Black Stars, and let's hear his comments now.
Coach Damba, we just watched, we just witnessed a game that was 12 years in the making, Uruguay versus Ghana. Ghana lost 2-0. What do you make of this game? Why did Ghana lose? Why were not? What happened?
Well, I must say, first and foremost, I need to congratulate the Ghana team in all adversities. There's always, you know,
silver lining.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because the game still continues. Well, but it was a very difficult one. Yes, 12 years down the line, you have mentioned it. It's been a very difficult time for especially Ghanaian fans to comprehend the fact that, you know, Suarez especially was the one who prevented us from getting to the semifinals historically. But that is football for you. Fans always have opinion, but then you have to face the reality.
Absolutely.
Today we played against a very experienced Uruguayan side. I must say, optimistically, I'm Ghanaian. I would have wished that Black Stars could proceed or could progress to the next step, but we played against a very, very mature, experienced, and of course, well-fired events, and we took their chances.
As a coach, what did the Black Stars need to do to win this game?
You know,
they did not do.
You know, to be very honest with you, it was a very strategic game. We needed at least 1 point. As to the approach of the game, whether it was right or wrong, the game is over. But going forward, I'm thinking that we could have resorted to our back three system where we could have, you know, a better consolidation in the middle part of the pitch. That's where we're playing three central defense and play our wide laterals to do the overlapping runs. That notwithstanding, you know, we could have gone down the same lane. But if it was meant, if we were meant to lose.
Hindsight is 2020.
Absolutely. We could still
have only lost. Needed a draw. Basically to protect the goal line. Mm-hmm. And not have Uruguay win.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about that first penalty. What do you think happened in that first penalty in terms of changing the dynamics for Ghanaians? Because it was a very crucial moment. It would have been an opportunity for them to be ahead, for the Black Stars to be ahead. Definitely, do you think that affected them mentally as well as they progressed?
Absolutely. You know, this was also a big moment, especially for the captain, who had to make amends. But then, I think he was also overwhelmed. And in situations like this, we have been there before. So we do understand the emotions that go through. And as much as he wanted to win the game, but I think it was a wasted opportunity. And we can't take anything away from the captain. We missed it, we lost it, we could have changed the whole dynamics. Because there was a fine margin that could have changed the whole dynamics of the game. But we lost it, we missed it, of course.
So this is going to be a long weekend in Accra because everybody was anticipating for a win.
Yes. It's got to be a very long weekend, and going forward, Ghanaians will have a little bit of a breather. You know why? Mm. Because Uruguay is also out of the tournament.
Yeah, that's the one thing.
That is the one thing. But
redemptive.
But then it doesn't change the dynamics. Okay. It doesn't change the dynamics.
I think they're calling to go back to the studio. Yes, Coach, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Still hurts to be eliminated, but maybe Ghanaians can smile a little bit that Luis Suarez and Uruguay are also out of the tournament. Jackson Vunganyi, thank you very much for talking with us from Accra.
Thank you so much, guys. Sporty greetings. And, you know, I will see you guys very soon. This was supposed to be a win for Ghana. I would have stayed in Accra a little longer, but, you know, my ticket is ready, so I'll see you guys on Tuesday.
All right. See you soon, brother. Safe travels.
I guess it was a public holiday in Ghana to watch that match against Uruguay. But, yeah, certainly kind of a put a damper on it to lose.
Absolutely. But as Coach had mentioned, the underlining positive is that Uruguay didn't make it through either.
You gotta find something.
It's gonna be a long weekend otherwise.
Well, let's take a look at some of the upcoming round of 16 matches. Let's go back to the match between those Lions, the three Lions of England, and the Lions of Taronga from Senegal, Mukbil. The head coach of England, Gareth Southgate, he describes Senegal as a very dangerous team. Koulibaly, he had his first international goal for Senegal. What role does he play on defense?
Honestly speaking, Sonny, I would say that Koulibaly is the heart and soul of that defense. And honestly, the whole team, he has the captain armband now, and he's really shown his resolve. And like you mentioned, for him to have his very first international goal for his country come at a goal that basically gives them the win to put them into the next phase of the tournament is unbelievable. It couldn't have come at a better time. It was very composed too. And it came right after a goal was scored on them. I believe it was like 2 to 3 minutes after, complete composure. So I definitely feel as though his main job is to just keep that back line in order. You know, he has his teammate in Chelsea, Mendy, who's in the back, you know, one of the better goalies from Africa, and in the entire tournament, he's been fighting to get his starting spot back. After this tournament, he might get it back. He's been looking good.
Well, Mukbil, if we talk goal scorers, we got three of the greatest still alive in this competition. Messi, Cristiano Ronaldo, Lewandowski from Poland. He'll be playing up against the defending world champions from France. France lost to Tunisia in their last group match. And I think we should talk about those Carthage Eagles from Tunisia. They played well in Qatar.
You know, sometimes the beauty of this game of football could also be the sadness sometimes, right? 90 minutes could mean anything. It's a world of a time for a team that, you know, needs to try to come back for. But when you're holding that lead, we've seen extra goal minutes happen. Iran scored in extra time twice against Wales. We've seen so many of these things happen. And Tunisia against France actually had an extra time goal by Griezmann within 1 minute of the whistle. But he was offsides. And honestly speaking, you could see the sadness in the Tunisian fans in the stadium. And it had nothing to do with them not being able to get to the next phase. It was more so about the pride of wanting to, at least if you're leaving the tournament, let's beat the defending world champions.
Right. Former colonial ruler.
Absolutely. Like they had so much invested in that game. And for it to almost be taken away in a draw was super saddening for their fans. But as soon as they went back to VAR, man, were they excited. so that's the beauty of it. But definitely thinking that France has the top scorer, tied for top scorer in the tournament
Mbappe,
right now.
Mbappe,
3 goals. Gakpo for the Netherlands, 3 goals. Alvaro Morata, 3 goals. Marcus Rashford from England, 3 goals. And an honorary mention for Inter Valencia, who was the first one to get to 3 goals, I believe. Okay. But his side, Ecuador, will not be on the other side for the knockout phases.
Now, it's still a little early, but Mbappe, should France retain its title? Do you see him maybe winning that golden ball as the best player in the tournament?
It's possible. It's just so open with having 4 players that have 3 goals and having another list of maybe 5 or 6 players with 2 goals each. You know, Messi has 2 goals. Richarlison has 2 goals. So it can be anyone's game. And in these knockout phases, this is really where it's going to start getting interesting for these goal scorers and see where it takes them. But the more you play in the tournament, the more opportunities you have for goals.
You were talking about late goals, Mukbil. The South Koreans with a very late goal against Portugal. It's just been a fun tournament in terms of some of the drama at the end of matches.
And honestly, this has been a tournament where you have to expect the unexpected. To have a team like Japan, who is an amazing team, by the way, very high-quality players, classic players, but nonetheless, you put them in a group with Spain and Germany. Who had them coming out of that group, let alone coming out of that group top? So it just goes to show you that as long as you have 90 minutes, you have a well-coached team, and every single player does what they need to do. And that's one thing about the Japanese and the South Koreans that they've shown us. They play for 90-plus minutes.
Very fit.
Amazing.
Very fit.
Looks like they might have 15 players on the pitch the way they're moving. Huh? These boys are moving fast.
Mukbil, you mentioned VAR, and I know we've had more than a few offside calls during this World Cup. What's your sense about the video review? Do you think maybe it's being used too much almost?
Honestly, it's a catch-22, I think. You know, you want these instances where you can go back and review, you know, a decision that could basically cost the entire game to go a different direction. But then you've seen other instances where we've lost the human touch in essence, I think. But yeah, I think it's going to be very interesting for the knockout phase. Sonny, what do you think?
Well, Mukbil, I think we might be out of time. Mukbil Yabaro, Sonny Young, you're on goal with Sonny and Mukbil. We are at the end of episode 3. Please join us again next week for episode 4. Mukbil, let's give a shout out for our producer, Mike Hove. Thank you, Mike, and thank you, Mr. Chang.